repertory ranges from madrigals to jazz and to avant-garde rock, for that matter. The contemporary brass quintet goes back only to the 1940s, but brass quintet performances and pieces have really taken off in numbers. What accounts for their popularity? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How many different kinds of brass quintets are there? Why is early music such a natural for brass quintet arrangements? And what kind of new compositions are out there? Our guest is Dan Graboy, professor of horn at the UW-Madison and a member of the Wisconsin Brass Quintet.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Why do you think it is that the brass quintet doesn't go back as far as something like the string quartet?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. In a sense, it goes back further. In the sense that we on brass instruments are very comfortable playing Renaissance music because a lot of that music was in fact written for brass, not brass instruments like our own. The valve hadn't been invented. Trumpets were often much simpler. Horns, probably French horns, weren't even involved. But that sound of brass, the sound that carries, was definitely in the air in the Renaissance. But then there was a period in the classical times when composers were using very little brass. And in the Romantic time, instruments got better. They became more important in the orchestra. And then we get up to modern times, and now suddenly there's a big interest in brass. And so now you have composers writing lots of music for brass. So we are now at the period that the string quartet was in at the time of Mozart and Beethoven, where we're adding big chunks of repertoire all the time.
I guess another difference is that unlike the string quartet or stringed instruments in general, brass has this kind of evolution that's fairly recent. I mean, constant improvements in valves and materials, for example.
That's very true. I was reading a book about the history of the violin, which made the point that there was the viol family of instruments, of which the bass, the modern bass, is a member, but the violin is not. And the cello, the violoncello, I believe is not. And all of a sudden, this new cousin of the viols sprang into being. And very quickly after that, Stradivarius was producing the best violins ever made. And it was just like Athena being born from out of Zeus's head. Just all
sudden.
Of a sudden, you had great instruments. The brass instruments, it's true, it's a much slower evolution. My instrument is the French horn or the horn. And it started as a metal tube. Well, it started as an animal horn that you could make a buzzing sound with your lips on. And then it turned into a metal tube. And it was wrapped around because it would be prohibitively long as far as carrying, especially on horseback. And the valve wasn't invented until the early part of the 19th century. It wasn't perfected for a long time. It wasn't accepted by everybody for an even longer time, and it is still being changed. We now have double horns, which are kind of two instruments in one. I actually play a triple horn. That's a relatively recent development that we now have triple horns.
All right. Now, how does that work? You just flip a switch and suddenly you're playing a different instrument?
Well, it's not a different instrument. So here's how it works. Every brass instrument is pitched in a key. What that means basically is that the lowest note you can play on that instrument is the note of the key. So let's say you have an instrument like the horn that's pitched in F. That means that if I don't push any buttons down, I play the harmonic series, for those listeners who know what that is, the F harmonic series. F, C, then F. I'm going up, then A, then C, then E flat, and so on. And there's a pattern that physics explains of notes called the harmonic series. And so if I'm playing an F horn, I can play without any buttons an F harmonic series. If I'm playing an E horn, I play an E harmonic series. So horn makers discovered, well, the problem with the horn, the basic horn in F, is that as you get higher in the harmonic series, the notes get closer and closer together. And it gets really hard to pick one out from its neighbors. Imagine a piano keyboard where the keys get narrower and narrower as you go up. So to hit the right note when you're up high requires a finger that's narrower than the finger you've got, and it's hard to hit the right one. So somebody had the brilliant idea that if you make a littler horn, a B-flat horn, that's B-flat higher than F, and figure out how to attach it to the F horn, then as you get higher, you can go on to that B-flat horn, and the notes aren't so close together. And so there's a button you work with your thumb to switch between, and they share a mouthpiece and the first piece of pipe, which is called the lead pipe. They share that, and they share a bell, and the bell is the end where the sound comes out. And then the valve sections of the two instruments are a little bit different because they have to be different sizes. So what about a triple horn? A triple horn has two thumb buttons. You work one of them with the end of your thumb, and you work the other with the knuckle in your thumb. It's a little bit complicated. The horn looks like a big mess, like if you had a bad plumbing job under your sink. That's what it looks like. But it gives you even better options for higher notes because now we have a little teeny high F horn on top.
And if we listen to a sample, one of those samples that you've brought here of a brass quintet, what's the instrumentation that we're going to hear?
You'll hear two trumpets, French horn, trombone, and tuba. Now, some brass quintets, instead of the tuba, have a bass trombone. Great example is the American Brass Quintet, which is, I believe, the oldest brass quintet that's still in existence, not with its original members, but that group is over 50 years old now. They've always been a quintet that uses bass trombone instead of tuba.
And I noticed that you've picked out something by Johann Petzl, who is a composer, especially at Christmas time, who seems to surface as a composer whose music is performed in brass. He was 17th century, I think, kind of a village-level musician. And did he then actually write for brass quintet?
So this is the point in which I say that I am not a historian. I am a player. And a lot of the historical questions, I will have to say, I don't know. And I don't really know, as a 16-year-old horn player, I was playing the music of Petzl in brass quintets, having no idea really who he was, and just thinking that his music was charming. And I honestly can't answer your question. I'm not sure what it's written for.
I think it's always played by brass.
We've taken him over as our own. He belongs to us now.
And in the recording you have from the New York Brass Quintet, what do we need to listen for before we hear it?
Right. So here's what you need to know, first of all. The New York Brass Quintet was, I would say, that's the group who's responsible for it all. That's a group that formed kind of coming out of World War II when everyone was playing in the army bands. And they got out of the army and they said, we want to play chamber music. And they were brass players and they basically said, what do we do now? There is no chamber music. Let's create this thing, and it'll be a brass quintet. And that group went until the mid to late 1980s and when they retired. And my teacher played in the group, and basically everybody's teacher played in the group, and was a hugely influential group of brass players who played in this group. And pedagogically, they taught lots of us. Either they taught us or they taught our teacher, who then taught us. And what I love about this group is just how beautifully musically they play. The lines are spectacular. The style is amazing. They really get it. They're musicians and first and brass players second.
New York Brass Quintet. I wonder about the ideal acoustics for a brass quintet. With that performance by the New York Brass, they almost have this church effect. But with a brass quintet, let's face it, the voices carry no matter where you are. Does it make a difference?
Well, we like resonance. On the other hand, when we're playing contemporary music, we also like clarity. And I would say that every musician on any instrument is looking for that perfect balance between resonance and ring, reverberation on the one hand and clarity on the other. And people get paid lots of money to design concert halls that theoretically provide both.
I used to play in woodwind quintets, and what I like there is you have the individual voices of the different instruments where you can hear the flute or the oboe or clarinet and so on, but then you also have that blend. Now, the French horn kind of has that unique position of being in both.
It does indeed, and it is a very different feeling playing in a brass quintet and playing in a wind quintet. In a brass quintet, I feel like the glue. I'm the glue in the middle that binds the trumpets on top down to the trombone and the tuba on the bottom. In a wind quintet, it can be very tricky to find a blend because the instruments are so different.
Right.
So there, I'm more like a big, fat, all-encompassing baseball glove that everyone can come sit inside on my padding.
What's another example of a brass quintet that you would point to that shows us something about the range?
I think we should listen to a Contrapuntus number 1 from The Art of Fugue by Bach. Bach's music works on any combination of instruments. And The Art of Fugue was written without instruments specified. So lots of groups have claimed this piece and done arrangements for their own ensemble.
Plus, Bach adapts to practically anything. It still comes through.
And it's such great music. And this is just a wonderful piece. The Art of Fugue has, I believe, 15 fugues, and they all are based on the same theme. Sometimes it's turned upside down. Sometimes it's switched, flipped in various ways. This is the very first one, and it's a very simple fugue, and you'll hear the fugue theme in its original form, and you will see how great it sounds when played by brass players. I'll also mention that this performance is by the Meridian Arts Ensemble, which is a group that I've played in since 1989. So this was on one of our very early recordings. And this is a piece that everybody plays in college. Everybody learns it. It's a huge part of the repertoire. And you basically learn how to play counterpoint with this piece.
Meridian Arts Ensemble with the Contrapuntus number 1 from The Art of Fugue by who else but Johann Sebastian Bach. Is Meridian Arts one of those ensembles that plays new music also?
We play a lot of new music. I would even say we specialize in new music. And we feel very strongly about playing the music that's being written today. Just like string quartets in Mozart's time wanted to play the music of today then, which was Mozart and Haydn. I mean, this is what musicians do. But before we get to the music of today, I want to look back even further than J.S. Bach and look at music that's about 500 years old, but some of it sounds like it could have been written yesterday. And this is music that many people who are interested in new music have been inspired by, including Stravinsky, who was a huge fan of the composer Don Carlo Gesualdo.
Yes, he was.
And many brass players have been playing his music, and I think for a couple of reasons. One, it's great. Two, it's usually written for a 5-part chorus, which works great in any quintet. And the weirdness of it is just wonderful. And because our ears are open to new music, we very much respond to Gesualdo's music.
But this is an arrangement then that's
been
done?
Well, it's an arrangement in the sense that trumpet one plays soprano one and trumpet two plays soprano two. But the piece we're going to hear has – the arrangement goes no deeper than that. And in fact, one of the players – this is, again, Meridian Arts Ensemble on the recording we'll hear. One of our players actually plays right off of the vocal score. So we did nothing except put dynamics, crescendos and diminuendos – yeah, into the part, and then figure out how we wanted it to go, of course. So this particular madrigal, and Gesualdo wrote madrigals. Madrigals are secular pieces, so composers in the Renaissance period were writing sacred music and secular music, and that's kind of the big divide, whereas now we have pop music versus whatever you'd call the music on the classical, I guess. That's a complicated term. So this piece by Gesualdo is a piece of secular music. It's a madrigal. It's called Mille Volte Il Di Moro, which means a thousand times a day I die. Much of this music is about love and death. And
the connection between the two.
Yes, and if you know Gesualdo's story.
Oh, it's pretty grim stuff.
It's quite grim, yes. He discovered his wife in the arms of her lover and killed them both with an axe. And the way people often think about the story is he then went on to write really weird music. That's a way oversimplification of the story. This style that he wrote in was current among a small handful of composers in the Renaissance. It's called the Mannerist style. And it represents a real stretching of how far you could push harmonies given what each melody was doing. So we're dealing with five melodies happening at the same time. That's called counterpoint. And whatever each melody does against each other produces harmony. So we have the horizontal element of the melody creating the vertical element of the harmony. And the Mannerist composers wanted to see just how far can we go with this? How far can we push this? So it sounds like Renaissance music. And then if you're kind of vacuuming the floor while you listen, it just sounds like Renaissance music. But if you sit and listen, you're going to say, wow, there's some really weird stuff going on in here.
Some harmonies there that are a little different, aren't they? A little indeed. Contemporary, you might say, for something that was written, as you say, about 500 years ago.
But very beautiful.
Yeah, he was a great composer.
We're going to look more at the music of the Brass Quintet when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Dan Grabois, who's filling us in about the repertory, it turns out to be considerable, of the Brass Quintet, which on the face of it is a fairly recent development from the years following World War II. We haven't really touched on the subject of brass music in the orchestral context, though. And if we look at some of the biggest orchestras, Mahler's, for example, What does he give to brass before we get into back into brass quintets?
Well, Mahler is one of our favorite composers for us brass players. He had, first of all, huge brass sections. So there are pieces, Mahler Symphony No. 3, for instance, has 8 horns, lots of trumpets, lots of trombones. He really knew how to write for brass. And in the Romantic period, when composers were looking for new colors, louder sounds, heightened emotions, it so happened that the technology of brass instruments had evolved to the point where the players could deliver what the composer needed. Furthermore, in the Romantic period, the harmonic palette, the range of chords that were being used in a piece had expanded tremendously, so that you would go from key to key very quickly and need all 12 notes of the scale. And as it happened, the valve by then had been perfected, so the brass players were able to participate in this. So if you look at brass parts in, say, a Mozart symphony, there's 2 horns and no other brass, sometimes 4 horns. And in the development section of the first movement of the piece, say, when the composer is going through lots of different keys and modulating and moving around, the horn players are sitting there kind of emptying their spit out of their horns and taking a breather because they can't play the notes.
Counting measures.
Mm-hmm. Counting measures rest, and often lots of them until we get back home and, okay, now we can use the horns again. In Mahler, we play all the time, and some of the most passionate music that Romantic composers wrote is in these roiling sections of development where you're going through lots of keys fast and hard, and the brass are great because they can bring a lot of power and depth of emotion to those sounds.
So at about that same time, Mahler, early 20th century, do we have composers working specifically in the brass quintet medium that give us that emotional, romantic push?
And the answer is sort of. You didn't really have brass quintets, but you had people playing in brass bands, mm-hmm. military bands, and you had composers, notably the composer who we dumb brass players call Victor Ewald. It's actually, I think, pronounced Ewald. But we just say Ewald. Ewald wrote music for these sort of band-like instruments, and it so happens that he wrote a lot of pieces, 4 or 5 of them. And again, they work in for 2 trumpets, horn, trombone, and either tuba or bass trombone. They work great, even though it may have been instruments like little cornets and alto horns and stuff like that that they were originally intended for. We have a little bit of romantic music that at least was intended for brass. So I've brought along a recording of one movement of the Ewald Brass Quintet No. 3, and it's beautiful, singing romantic style, and it's played by the New York Brass Quintet. These guys really knew how to play in this style, and it's just a beautiful movement.
Got that great late 19th century gentility to it.
It is a beautiful piece.
You also compose. I know you didn't bring an example of that, but you compose for the brass quintet, right?
I do.
And is that partly to sort of fill what you see as a void in the repertoire?
I would say no. I do it because it's fun. And because if you play in a group and you write for the group plays your music.
It's, instant gratification.
It is just wonderful to be able to write for your colleagues. And I've written for the Meridian Arts Ensemble, and I've written for the Wisconsin Brass Quintet. We just premiered a piece that I wrote for our 40th anniversary. And we have a few more performances before the academic year is up. I enjoy writing music, and I enjoy writing for my colleagues because I know how they play. So the piece that I wrote for the WBQ, for the Wisconsin Brass Quintet, I had John Ailey's trumpet sound in my ear, and I wrote him a lot of big solos that were that I knew he would just play the devil out of. Mm-hmm. And he was playing them great. It's just really satisfying.
You brought an example of a colleague's work, John Stevens' composition for the Wisconsin Brass Quintet. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So John Stevens is the tuba professor at UW-Madison, has been for 20-some years. And he's a prolific composer, largely for brass, but he's written tons of pieces, and they're all great. This is a piece that the group actually recorded. I am not the horn player on the recording because it goes back a few years, and I'm only in my second year at UW-Madison. But this is a piece called Fabrics, and the CD is called Fabrics, and the particular movement from the piece Fabrics is Flying Geese, and it shows what brass are doing nowadays. It's very different from what we do when we play much older music, but new music is very exciting and sounds great on brass because everything sounds great on brass.
From a non-wind player, it's hard to tell what's difficult and what's not difficult. Contemporary music for brass, does that tend to be just physically more demanding of the player than some of the older things?
Yes, it often is. And playing a brass instrument can be a physical challenge. I would say especially for the trumpet players when they're often playing high and loud, that takes a lot of lip strength. If you think about attaching a half-pound weight to a piece of string and then putting that string between your lips and trying to hold up that weight, I mean, that's not really a parallel of what we do, but you'll notice quickly that your lips are not very strong. But to play a brass instrument, your lips need to be quite strong. And so, yes, physically, new music can be very, very challenging.
So do brass players tend to, I don't want to use the word burn out exactly, but retire more quickly or earlier in life than string players?
I would say, in general, yes. It's very easy to keep playing too long past the point at which you feel you can get the job done. And you'll see 75-year-old string players doing a great job. It's pretty rare to see the 75-year-old brass player still doing a great job, especially on repertoire that's just rip-roaring loud and hard and fast and challenging. On the other hand, people do keep playing. So Robert Nagel, who was the principal trumpet player in the New York Brass Quintet, he's, I believe, around 80 years old. He's retired but still plays the trumpet and still likes playing the trumpet.
In the piece we just heard, The Flying Geese by John Stevens, it was difficult to listen to that without picturing the flying geese, the sort of program music approach. But what were some of the techniques that the brass players were using in that that made it different than the earlier music?
Well, the thing that first you hear is harmonically, the chords that are being used, which I don't know if people could hear, but to my ear, they very much sound like they come out of the world of jazz. And they're being put into a non-jazz context, but those are chords that you will hear a big band play. And that's different. And getting those chords in tune is different. And feeling those chords and how they move from one to the other is different. But I also agree with you. The piece is very evocative. You can really kind of see the geese on the ground and then taking off and mm-hmm. taking flight as a group with a little bit of rambunctiousness at the beginning and then streamlining into a V pattern.
Well, and it's interesting because the brass quintet can go from sounding very church-like and resonant, you know, almost like a Gregorian chant only with brass, to sounding very bright and aggressive.
We have our feet in many worlds, many, many worlds. And the jazz world, the rock and roll world, the early sounds world, there's lots that we can do. And when we start using mutes and different colors, that our palette becomes even more expanded. And that kind of puts the counterbalance to what I was saying before, that brass blends beautifully. And it does blend beautifully. But at the same time, we can play with a lot of pizzazz and punch and different kinds of styles. And I would say that the overall overarching subject of interest to brass players is style. So any piece that we get, and especially since we play lots of new music, the question is, what's the style? What are we trying to accomplish here stylistically? And we really have to wear lots of different stylistic hats. That's what makes it fun to be a brass player.
Now, you have some Lutoslavsky with you, and I think of Lutoslavsky as being pretty straightforward 20th century, late 20th century classical composer. But are there other styles in this that you've brought?
Well, in this particular piece? Well, this is a really fun piece. It's very short. It's called Mini Overture. And it is aggressive and powerful. We had a coach back when we were students, we had a coach who told us that it needed to sound stupid. And there is something a little bit oaf-like about some of the sections, and it really takes advantage of the aggressive possibilities in brass instruments that I think are harder to come by in the other families. But if you think of the Bartok string quartets, you'll see Bartok looking for ways to create more aggressive sounds. And with brass, that's easy. But Lutoslavsky comes up with this real sparkling piece, Mini Overture, and it has these strong sections where we're sort of arguing with each other, but it's also lightning quick and exciting, and I think is a great introduction for people to listen to modern sounds and be able to not just say, that's dissonant, and I like it when it's not dissonant. But to say, well, that's dissonant, and that's really fun, that's exciting, that's sparkling, that's vivacious and kind of angry and kind of stupid. Thank you.
That's pretty frenetic.
It is.
And just a really different sound than what we were hearing before.
Very much so. And you'll hear some mutes in there, some different colors. A mute is just a conical-shaped gizmo that we stick in the bell, and it doesn't mute the horn, really. It's the word mutare in Italian means change. It changes the sound. Often, if you need a trumpet to slice through the texture, you put a mute in it, it can slice much better. It's a very aggressive nasal sound, and there are different mutes that provide different kinds of sounds. That's just another weapon in our arsenal of making as much color as we possibly can.
We're going to hear a lot more color in the next few minutes as we range from Alvin Ettler to Frank Zappa when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Daniel Graboy, and we're talking about the brass quintet. Tell us, now that we're moving into, you know, contemporary times, tell us about the influence of jazz on quintet music.
It's huge. It's huge. First of all, jazz has always included brass. Jazz trumpet, of course, Louis Armstrong, Clifford Brown, one of the greatest trumpet players ever to live, died at age 25. For people who don't know Clifford Brown, go check him out. But jazz has been a natural for brass quintets because it's something that we do. Now, for French horn players, it's a little more foreign. A lot of horn players don't have that skill of improvising in their bag of tricks. And I know for me, starting to play a lot with brass quintets meant learning how to play in a jazz style.
And is there a particular quintet piece that we can hear that shows jazz in the quintet?
Yes, there is. We heard a little bit of jazz sounds in the John Stevens Flying Geese piece, and we'll hear a little bit more in the second movement of Alvin Ettler's brass quintet. This is a piece that was a trial by fire for me when I joined the Meridian Arts Ensemble. The group had been going for a while before I joined, and I joined the group, and they said, great, we have a concert in a couple of weeks, and we're playing the Alvin Ettler quintet, and it's hard, and I had to learn it in a big hurry. We're going to hear the second movement, and it definitely has a jazz sensibility underlying it. In this particular movement, it's not quite as evident as in some of the movements, but there's an interesting story. What brass players have always said, and I don't know where this story came from, is that Alvin Ettler lost a son in the Korean War, and then he wrote this piece, and it's mournful, and it has these sort of jazz songs in it that are very heartfelt. And then in this second movement, it has a Morse code SOS. So we used to tell this story before we performed this piece, and we performed it probably hundreds of times. And then we learned that, in fact, Alvin Ettler did not have a son in the Korean War, and that the whole story was apocryphal. Nonetheless, this movement, the theme goes digadit da 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 digadit, which I believe is the Morse code SOS.
Da 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 da.
Yep. And so you'll hear digadit da 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 digadit digadit da 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 over and over again, building energy with kind of jazz harmonies underneath it. Again, you were talking about frenetic kinds of sounds in the Lutoslawski. I would say that's kicked up even yet another notch in this Ettler piece. Also, we were talking about the difficulty, the physical difficulty of playing brass instruments. To that, I would add that when you're playing contemporary music, you're dealing with mental difficulties as well, such as counting a piece that's going by incredibly fast, and the meter is in five, and it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just really fast, and learning how to do that, that's part of the brass player's art for sure. Thank you.
So is rhythm the hardest part of that then?
Yeah, rhythm's the hardest part. Definitely.
What about the slower, more balanced side of jazz?
We can do that. We can definitely do that. I brought a recording of a piece called Sanctity. It's by a New York composer, Jason Forsythe. I believe he's a jazz trombone player. And this is a straight-out jazz ballad, although it's not has no improvisation, and it was written specifically for a brass quintet. It's just beautiful. We, in the Meridian Arts Ensemble, we performed this piece many, many times, including at the wedding of our trombone player. He liked it so much that we had that at that occasion a large number of years ago.
It's really beautiful. And you can hear those sort of bluesy notes and slides.
Very much so. And it requires completely different playing style. And again, that's what makes it fun.
So is it fudging for a brass quintet to work with a drummer?
We in Meridian Arts Ensemble do it all the time. Most of what we do is with a drummer. And the reason, it goes back a large number of years, but we started playing some jazz pieces. And then we started playing some rock pieces.
Can't play rock or not much without a drummer, I guess.
It doesn't sound as good. So we added a drummer to the group back in maybe 1991, something like that. And that group's been going with drums ever since. And I've brought a few selections of pieces that have drums. And, yeah, you need a certain kind of feel for certain kinds of music. And so if you have your own group, you can do whatever you want. The world's an open place. And so we're a sextet. Often we're a brass quintet with drums. We've become a working sextet, and that opened the door to lots of different kinds of music, like Latin music. So the piece Patterson 235 is a piece of Latin music, but it was written by one of the trumpet players in Meridian, John Nelson.
Why is it called Patterson 235?
So musicians need to make ends meet in any way they possibly can. And one way is to play Latin gigs in Patterson, New Jersey.
I somehow wondered if it wasn't Patterson, New Jersey.
It is. And John remembered going out to Patterson, which was not a particularly wonderful town to go to, and taking the 235 train back. That's AM when the gig ended. And so he wrote this piece. And what's particularly fun about this piece, which very much has the flavor of, I mean, it is a piece of Latin music, a piece of salsa, but it is also in 5/4 time. It's in 5. You're not going to notice it unless you start counting from downbeat to downbeat, but it's a Latin tune in 5. I don't know if it's the only Latin tune in 5, but it is one of them.
A 5/4 rhythm there, which doesn't sound like one, sounds easier than that? Sounds more conventional, and that's part of what, art concealing art?
I guess you might say it's part of a composer having a really good time and taking up a challenge and then learning how to play it is tricky. The beat keeps kind of sliding away from you unless you keep on top of it.
It's hard not to dance to that, something like that.
That's good to hear.
You mentioned also that your group, the Meridian Arts Ensemble, does rock. Can you say something about rock and the brass quintet?
I certainly can. Well, one of the things that brass instruments do very well is power. And playing powerfully is a big part of rock and roll. And we have that. And with the drums, we have the sound. Our tuba player, as you heard in the last selection, can play a mean bass line. So all the elements of rock are there. And we got interested first in the music of Frank Zappa, and we'll end a little bit later with a piece by Zappa. But we started playing some of Zappa's music, and that led us to other kinds of rock music. And I got very interested in the music of Captain Beefheart. So Captain Beefheart's real name is Don Van Vliet. He died a few years ago. He had a band called Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. He actually grew up with Frank Zappa in the desert in Southern California. And he was kind of a odd fellow, very poetic, very into strange music, as was Zappa, and never felt like he fit in where he was. And he ended up putting together this band, the Magic Band, and I would say writing a lot of music, except he didn't actually write it. He whistled each line to the players in his band because he couldn't write music down. And they learned to play this music, and it was extremely odd. And he came out with one album called Trout Mask Replica, and that's kind
of course.
That's kind of classic Beefheart, very strange with the words. And that I would say that Captain Beefheart is probably the most influential musician you've never heard of. And Trout Mask Replica is probably the most influential album you've never heard of. And when rock musicians are asked who's important in rock and roll, they will all say Captain Beefheart. And if you say which album, they will all say Trout Mask Replica. So the selection that we're going to hear is not off of that particular album. It's off another one. And the piece is called Suction Prince. That's P-R-I-N-T-S. Suction Prince, which I imagine is what a octopus leaves on your arm after it pulls off. And it's a strange piece of music, and I love strange pieces of music. Is it rock? I guess it is, because some of it has a rock beat, but it's also new music. It's modern, but it's not modern. I mean, it's real boundary-crossing stuff.
Sounds in that.
Yes.
I don't even know what to call it.
I don't either.
I'd call it Captain Beefheart, Suction Prince.
You mentioned Zappa, and let's go out on that. Tell us what we're going to hear.
Right. So Zappa was a prolific composer. He released, I think, 63 or so albums of music, and he died quite young.
Named his daughter Moon Unit.
He named one of his daughters Moon Unit, indeed. And one of his sons, Dweezil,
right,
and was a strange person. And his favorite composer was Varese, Edgar Varese.
Oh, yeah, that right. Yeah, that's
and
right.
Zappa
the electronic
loved,
composer.
Yeah, he loved modern music, and he created a rock band because he knew if he just wrote modern music, no one would ever play it. And if you had a rock band, people would play his music. But he was always drawn to contemporary rhythms and sounds, but also wrote a lot of great rock and roll. We actually, in Meridian Arts Ensemble, started doing arrangements of his pieces and sending him tapes, cassette tapes of our arrangements. And he eventually called our trumpeter, John Nelson, who had done a lot of the arrangements, and invited us to come to his house. And we went to his house.
You see the Busendorfer piano?
Well, we were this, yes, and the studio was huge, and we had a coaching with him, and we went back when he was actually on his deathbed and played for him 3 weeks before he died, played another set of music. So we all told had about 20 Zappa pieces in our repertoire at one point. And the piece that we're going to hear is called Echidna's Arf, again, with the wordplay. An echidna is a spiny anteater. It's an ugly, nasty-looking... looks a little bit like a hedgehog with a long nose. And Zappa said that echidnas don't make a sound at all, but if they were to make a sound, they would make the sound arf. I don't know what that has to do with this piece of music. You'll hear all of the challenges for brass instruments in this piece. It's fast. There's a million notes. It's exciting. We make lots of different colors and different kinds of sounds. It's extremely fun to play. I would say we performed this at least 200 times. It was just a huge favorite of ours and an audience favorite as well.
And a long way from Bach.
Very long way. We've come a long distance.
That is the sound, believe it or not, of just six musicians, brass quintet plus drummer. And the brass quintet was the Meridian Arts Ensemble with drummer added. And the work there of Frank Zappa. Our guest has been Dan Graboy of brass fame and the Wisconsin Brass Quintet. He is a hornist and professor of horn at UW-Madison. Pleasure having you with us and exploring the wonderful world of brass.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.